Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. We have a special program today, a two-hour show with plenty of coverage of next Tuesday's election and the issues and candidates that matter here in the Valley. In the first hour, we'll break down the ballot measures with the Fresno Bee's Bill McEwen and Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke. We'll also hear from both of the candidates for state controller. In the first hour, Ashley Swearingen, and then later in our show, Betty Yee. And we'll talk to the reporter who broke the story about a woman who has been traveling across the country to national parks like Yosemite, vandalizing natural features with her artwork, and then boasting about it on social media websites. But first, FM 89's Deanna Aguilera brings us a story from the Kern County community of Arvin. Earlier this year, eight families in that town were forced out of their homes due to a gas leak on a pipeline that comes from a nearby oil field operation. Now, 7 months later, those families are still asking questions about their health and when they can return to their neighborhood.
When Yesenia Lada bought her home 3 years ago, she never imagined living there would eventually bring so much anger and sadness to her family.
This is my house. This is my casa. Excuse the mess, but I hardly come here.
Yes, you heard her right. She rarely goes to her own house in Arvin, southeast of Bakersfield, because she's not allowed to live there. It's been this way since the evening of March 18th.
They came to the house, told everybody to. They had evacuated within an hour. And they said, okay, you have to grab whatever you can, approximately for 7 days. We're evacuating everybody because we are in danger of explosion.
On that day, Kern County officials evacuated families from eight homes on Nelson Court after they discovered a toxic gas leak from an underground pipeline. Testing results found dangerous and explosive levels of flammable gases, including methane and benzene, near and inside the homes.
What we determined in a few of the homes is it exceeded the explosive level. In other words, if there was a source of ignition and those gases were able to concentrate, it potentially could explode.
That's Matt Constantine, the director of Kern County Public Health. He says the gas had saturated the soil underneath the houses and was spreading inside. But this isn't like the natural gas that runs to your stove or heater. It's a pipeline that carries field gas. It's raw waste gas from a nearby oil field that's being sent to a well flare to burn off. The pipeline belongs to Petro Capital Resources. Now, 7 months after the evacuation order, residents like Yesenia Lada have yet to return.
Nobody thought it was going to take this long. I think this is the first time in history, I think, locally that something this severe has happened.
Up to this point, no one knows how long it's been since the line started leaking. But some families say they've noticed the smell of gas for several months and even years. Lara, the mother of three, says the situation got so bad her six-year-old son's nose wouldn't stop bleeding.
My son, I had to take him to Fresno one time because he started bleeding in the morning and it was 9 o'clock on p.m. and the bleeding wouldn't stop.
After the families were evacuated, Lara found out they weren't the only ones with strange symptoms.
We started talking to each other, you know, once we were at the hotel, and everybody. Everybody has the same thing. Headache, dizziness. And, you know, like getting tired easily.
Once the company realized it would take months to conduct testing, they housed the families in an apartment complex in Bakersfield. But 16-year-old Sabrina Garcia says the families just want to know the truth.
I would want them to tell me if my house is going to be clear to go in. And if not, they should tell us that it's not going to work out. And, you know, just be straight up with us and tell us we're not getting our house back.
When the evacuation was ordered back in March, it took a few days for the county to figure out who owned that specific pipeline. Larry Pickett is a spokesman for PCR, the company that owns the line. Pickett says PCR immediately shut down the pipeline and began to clean up the soil.
The latest is that all of the initial testing of the locations, air and water, was completed. results were given to the county health department.
In late August, PCR said their cleanup efforts were successful and told residents it was safe for them to return home. But the families weren't satisfied. They wanted a second opinion. And in October, the Kern County Board of Supervisors agreed to move forward with new testing. Leticia Perez is a Kern County supervisor.
They asked the county if we would please do our own confirmatory testing so they could have some peace of mind and feel that their children, their families, their animals are going to be safe if they choose to return home.
But some, like Juan Flores with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, say the county could have done a better job.
It's way too late. The county is really going to come out to do their own studies. What gases are they going to find?
Flores has been working closely with the residents since March.
Some of them had been working their whole life as farm workers. And the little money that they had been able to save, they invested it into buying these homes. And all of a sudden, that American dream that they were fighting for has turned into a nightmare.
Back at Nelson Court, Elvia Garcia gives me a tour of her deserted home. Garcia has lived for 20 years in her house in Arvin. She says she expected more support from the county, but at the end, she was just disappointed.
I spoke to them and asked them to do a medical checkup when we got evacuated to see if my kids are healthy, but the county said no. I spoke to someone who told me they're not going to do anything about it.
I asked both the county and the company who would pay for the family's medical expenses, and so far they're pointing fingers at each other.
From my perspective, the company is responsible to pay for those services. It was their line. Their break caused these harms, I believe, at least in cost, is the responsibility of the company.
That's Supervisor Leticia Perez. But Larry Pickett, the spokesman with PCR, says they're not the only ones who should take responsibility.
It hasn't even come up in discussion, so I don't know whether they'd go to county health, and then county health might get the oil company involved at that point.
The county says additional testing is already happening, but it's not clear when the results will be released. In the meantime, residents remain in Bakersfield, hoping if they're lucky enough, they'll be home by Christmas. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Diana Aguilera.
You're listening to a special edition of FM 89's Valley Edition. Our program today is largely themed around the upcoming election. Later this hour, we'll break down the ballot measures that will go before California voters next Tuesday. Right now, though, we'll look at the race for what is usually one of the most overlooked statewide offices, state controller. This year, though, it's actually one of the most competitive races, as two candidates vie to be the state's top fiscal watchdog. In the second hour of our election special, we'll hear from Democrat Betty Yee, who narrowly edged out fellow Democrat John Perez in the June primary for second place in the new top two election format. The candidate who finished first in the race for state controller, that would be Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearengen, a Republican. With 2 years left in her term at City Hall, Swearengen essentially gets a free shot in a run for statewide office. While most polls show Yee with a significant lead, the former economic development official at Fresno State hopes to pull off an upset while at the same time boosting her name recognition and her profile in a California GOP that is searching for relevancy. I recently had a chance to speak with Swearengen, first about a few issues at City Hall, and then about the campaign for state controller. Mayor Swearengen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about the state controller's race, I have a few local issues I want to talk about. In a few weeks, the city council will vote on the new 2035 general plan update. This is a big deal. It's been millions of dollars. It's been going on for years. And for the first time, would direct a good portion of the city's growth inward rather than outward. However, in talking to a lot of people around the community, there's a lot of criticism from multiple sides. You have developers who are concerned about this focus on infill and whether this is really practical. And then you have others in the community who say the original goal of the general plan, the original intent of focusing on infill has been watered down some, especially after the BRT issue. And they're worried about whether this is really leaving older neighborhoods behind. How do you answer critics when you're getting criticism from both sides on something like this?
Well, first of all, this is really a watershed moment for our city. And the council will be asked to consider and adopt in roughly mid-December a general plan that says over a 30-year period of time, approximately half of growth and investment will happen within our existing city limits, as defined by city limits in December of 2012, and the remaining half will be directed to new growth areas, two of which will be open immediately upon adoption of the plan, and other new growth areas that will be phased as infill goals are met over time, and as we fill in some of the first two new growth areas, we'll phase the other growth areas. And that has never been done before in the city of Fresno. We have never contemplated a strategic sort of phasing of our new growth. So that in and of itself certainly is groundbreaking. And for those who would say that our plan is not going to accomplish its intended goal of trying to take care of what we've already got, I would point to that and say, you know, we're phasing new growth. We are allowing new growth. So for the developers, I would say, what are you talking about? You've got plenty of land in this general plan. In fact, today we've got about 10 years worth of inventory of approved maps already. So it's not as if the city is suggesting that we're not going to have new home, single family construction in our future. Of course we are, but we're just saying we're going to phase it in a manner that we're certain before we pop out in Southeast Fresno and Central East Fresno, we know that we've actually got a market and we've got demand. And in doing so, we're not going to leave behind further neighborhoods and create blight for future generations. So for the developers, I would challenge, I think both sides, frankly, are dealing with some emotion, and we need to look at the data and the actual strategies that are laid out in the plan. And what you'll find is a straight down the middle kind of approach to addressing the longstanding problems that we've seen in our community. We've got a lot of support in the middle, a lot of young professionals, a lot of residents who are saying, you know, I'm not for one side or the other, but I'm just tired of seeing the blight line in Fresno creep further and further north. And before we go expanding our boundaries any farther, we need to make sure that we're taking care of what we've already got, what we've already built, and look for ways to incent reinvestment and infill along the Blackstone Corridor, Shaw Avenue, places where we still have room to convert parking lots, for example, into different types of buildings and different types of structures. And over time, over the life of the plan, really create a vibrant middle of the city, because frankly, that's good for everybody. Property values throughout the city will benefit from the older, dilapidated parts of the city being improved today.
It's a different council than it was a few years ago when they approved going down this path. How confident are you that you have the votes in December?
Well, I've learned to never be overly confident or pessimistic. I mean, it's just literally a day by day. I believe that the majority of the council will support this plan, and then we'll turn to the next major item, which will be adopting a new development code. And for folks who are listening, maybe thinking, you know, gosh, all this stuff is too technical. I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, the development code is the technical document that allows for the implementation of the general plan. And what's never been done before, at least in a long, long time in Fresno, is the concurrent review, evaluation, and adoption of the general plan, which is all about policy and broad statements about what we want to be when we grow up, essentially. And at the same time, then turning and saying, now, does our development code enable that vision to be implemented?
A few months ago, a company came to City Hall wanting to expand its operations. It's a company called Brentag. They have a chemical warehouse facility in Fresno, and they wanted to expand to a new location. And it came to the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission rejected that proposal over concerns from residents in the area about having another heavy industry facility. This is a neighborhood in West Fresno that has been ranked as one of the most polluted in the state of California in the new Cal Enviro Screen area. You appealed that decision to the city council, and the city council approved that expansion and that new facility. I hear criticism from some of those residents in that area saying the mayor talks about investing in older neighborhoods and how it's been unfair in some ways how the city has grown in the past. If we really want to change that, though, where do you make the first step? Can you tell me why you appealed that and walk us through that issue?
You bet. I appealed it because this is an existing business in Fresno that has over a 30-year track record of operating in our community. Not once have there been complaints about odors. Not once have there been complaints about any sort of impact from their operations in the neighborhood that they're moving not far from their current location. So while I think the sentiment and the emotion that was expressed from some residents who were nearby, really probably is better aimed at some other users in the area that have been notorious for odors and other other actions. I think it got inappropriately placed on the shoulders of this good actor that literally we could look at the decades of operation and say, there's no problem. There have been no problems with this facility. So that's why I appealed it, and I believe that's why the council supported them moving not too far away in order to expand and basically maintain the type of operation they had maintained in Southwest Fresno for a long time. Having said that, these same residents have raised the bigger issue of, should we allow industrial development at all, industrial uses at all, anywhere south of Shaw Avenue in the city of Fresno, for example. And there are some legitimate points the group makes. There are also some obvious things they overlook. So, for example, we know that we've got to have industrial activity in the Fresno area in order to fuel the economy, number one. Number two, we know that industrial activity requires freeway access and rail access. So when you look at the places in our city where freeway and rail access intersect, there are only a few choices for where that activity is going to take place. And it's where there's heavy industrial use today. I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic, that between now and when the general plan is presented to the council, that we might be able to make some accommodations, certainly create some better buffers in the places where residential bumps up next to industrial bumps up next to residential. I'm hopeful that we can find some ways to mitigate that more than maybe is in the plan today. But it's just simply unrealistic to say we're not going to have industrial in the city of Fresno, or that we can locate it in places that aren't close to rail access. So as with the other broader issues, there are always very extreme opinions on either side. Our job is to hear their concerns, to listen to the legitimate points they're making, see if there is a way to accomplish the goals of the plan while also recognizing the legitimate concerns they're bringing forward, and try to find the path forward that best mitigates the genuine concerns but still creates an economic base for the Fresno area.
We're talking with Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen on our program today. Wanted to talk about some Fresno issues. Now I want to move on to the campaign. The state controller's office is one that kind of flies under the radar of most Californians. Ask the average Californian on the street, they might not be able to tell you what the state controller does. But one of the big functions is you would sit on the Board of Equalization. You would also sit on the boards of CalPERS and CalSTRS, the retirement systems that are absolutely gigantic in their assets and their size, and also their responsibilities. There's been a lot of talk about pension reform and about the way the CalPERS board has handled certain things. Earlier this year, the CalPERS board instituted 99 bonuses for CalPERS employees. Some people say that weakened existing reform efforts. How concerned are you about that and about the overall pension picture? CalPERS has huge assets, but some people say it still concerns unfunded liabilities.
Well, I absolutely am concerned about it, and not in a frantic, fear-mongering kind of way, but you cannot look at the state of California's finances and assess where we are today and not recognize that we have to be as aggressive as possible when it comes to addressing unfunded liabilities. So not just when it comes to pensions, but today, the best estimate that we can put forward without access to all of the internal data, it looks as if there is about $500 billion worth of indebtedness, unfunded liabilities in the state of California. That equates to about $13,000 of outstanding liabilities and unfunded liabilities for every Californian in the state. That is a mountain of debt. And while I praise Governor Brown for attacking the wall of debt, it's terrific to bring down the shorter wall. There's a mountain of debt behind it, and we have to keep going and addressing the state's overall unfunded liabilities and outstanding liabilities. So that's one thing as a candidate I've been recommending, is that every year the state controller's office needs to produce a comprehensive, accurate, transparent, complete list of the state's outstanding liabilities and unfunded liabilities so that every Californian knows when the particular year's budget debate comes up and we're fighting over this or that, we can have that debate in the context of the overall financial position of the state. And as the CFO of the state, I believe it's my responsibility to make sure a light is being shown in every nook and cranny of the state's treasury.
There's no incumbent in this race. You're facing Betty Yee, who's currently on the Board of Equalization. But I'd be curious to know your thoughts on existing controller John Chung. You've had an interesting perspective in local government dealing with the state. He's been in office for going on 8 years now. What's your analysis of how he's been serving in that role?
Well, I have a little bit of a mixed assessment. I certainly have respected some positions he's taken, and he had to serve during a time when literally no one was quite sure how much cash flow the state of California had and whether or not it could fulfill its liabilities on a month-to-month basis. So I very much respect some of the tough decisions and positions that he took. I will say, though, that I was very troubled to read in May of this last year the state auditor's report on the state controller's office. So in addition to the state controller, there is a state auditor, not an independently elected auditor, but someone who reports the administration to the legislature. And every year they pick a handful of departments of government, state government, to do a complete audit. Well, this year it was the state controller's office's turn. And the state auditor's report, if you actually go and read it, identifies major, major problems in the office. Billions of dollars of arithmetic errors having been made by staff within the state controller's office. Communication gaps between the state controller's office and departments throughout state government they need to work with. And what that suggests to me is that there is definitely a need for improving the management within the office. And I have called for an outside management audit from day one. I've said, look, we got to bring outsiders in from top to bottom, do a management audit. And then from there, stand up a standing audit committee that meets on a regular basis throughout my time in office that is constantly evaluating how we're doing to improve the management of that office relative to what the management audit team finds initially upon my election. So there's a tremendous need to improve the operations. And what I find so often in elected office, oftentimes you'll find principals who are technically proficient and may or may not exercise political courage every now and then. But oftentimes there is a shortfall when it comes to the management expertise to actually run the agency they're heading up. What I am making sure voters know is that I'm the candidate in this race that actually has the elected executive experience as a strong mayor of Fresno, the elected CEO of the city of Fresno. I today run a billion-dollar agency with 3,200 employees. I am directly responsible and accountable to the people for all the things that get done right in our city, as well as things that don't get done right. My opponent does not have that type of management experience. And in fact, it's why I've been endorsed by literally every newspaper in California, except for the San Francisco Chronicle. But every newspaper in the state, with one exception, has said that I've got the experience to lead the office forward that my opponent doesn't have, and that, in fact, she lacks government agency experience that I bring to the table.
Earlier in this campaign, your opponent, Betty Yee, criticized your management of the city of Fresno, saying you failed to deliver on promises to make the city a better place to live, and blamed you for soaring deficits and unbalanced budgets. Your campaign took issue with that, saying you inherited a bad situation. Now your campaign has produced a website attacking Betty Yee, saying that she led California deep into debt through association with then-Governor Gray Davis when she was on his finance staff, and blaming her in part for the state's drop in revenue during the dot-com bust from 1999 to 2003. Aren't both of those claims in some way a little bit simplistic to blame the other for these large things that are going on?
Well, first of all, my opponent's attacks on my track record in the city of Fresno is simply wrong. I mean, it's just flat out inaccurate and wrong. And in fact, the Fresno Bee, in an editorial just after she released her claims, called her out for, quote, dirty campaigning and basically said, you got to get the facts right, okay? My assertion is that as the deputy finance director in the Davis administration, if she's not responsible or at least partially responsible for $35 billion in debt after just 4 years in office, if she's not partially responsible, then who is? And I've heard her say, oh, that wasn't my job, that wasn't my job. Well, guess what? I've actually served in an elected executive position where I am directly responsible for the things that have happened on my watch. And she's trying to deflect the fact that she really had nothing to do with those deficits. I'm saying, well, that's exactly my point. You lack the executive elected experience that I bring to the table. If you weren't responsible for those deficits, then you either weren't doing your job to advise your boss, or you were advising your boss to make different decisions and you didn't have enough credibility in the administration for him to follow the course of action you were recommending. You can't have it both ways.
You've yet to make an endorsement in the governor's race. That drew criticism from some of your Republican colleagues throughout the state. Have you had that conversation with Neel Kashkari yet, that there was talk that you might have?
No. In fact, you know, I know this may come as a bit of a surprise, but we've both been a little busy lately. And I've been on the campaign trail making the case to the voters that I'm the right pick for the state controller's office. And literally once or twice we've passed in the hallway, but we've not had a chance to meet. And, you know, my decision to not be active in the governor's race just really comes down to the fact that I believe that the chief financial officer of the state of California, of all positions in state government, must at all times demonstrate independence and a freedom from bias, and demonstrate to people that, you know, I'm willing to call balls balls and strike strikes, and that doesn't always align me with one party or the other. But I'm used to that because as the mayor of the city of Fresno, I serve today in a nonpartisan office, and there are times when people on the right are upset with me. Sometimes they like me. Times when people on the left like me, sometimes they don't like me. And I've just learned that kind of middle of the road approach, when either side may experience a little bit of frustration with you at one point or another, that's probably, all things considered, the right overall balance for handling the public's business.
Speaking of the governor, how would you characterize your relationship with Governor Brown? You gave him a tour of the Fulton Mall back in January. Is there any maybe state money coming to Fresno anytime soon for the downtown projects you've been a big advocate for? What's your relationship like with Jerry Brown?
Well, we've actually worked well with the Brown administration and have found places where we certainly have aligned interests. They're very focused on revitalization of major inner cities throughout California. They're very concerned about low-income communities and environmentally challenged communities. And when you're looking through those two lenses, Fresno certainly rises to the top. So we've had the benefit of working with some of his top staff and trying to find ways to incent private investment into places of our city that today just simply can't attract that investment because of the market and the dynamics. So there are certainly places where we agree. I enjoyed giving Governor Brown a tour of Fulton Mall. He was very supportive of our plan to reconstruct the street. And in fact, the state is providing some match. When the federal government provided $16 million for the project, we needed to come up with an additional $4 million for the project, and the state's doing a couple million, and then we have some local grant dollars to finish out that match. So they are a partner in the project. And, there are times when I agree with the governor's actions. There are times when I don't agree. But as mayor of the city of Fresno, at all times, I expect to and have experienced having a seat at the table. And for that, I'm very grateful.
You talked about the important role the state controller's office plays come budget time and providing those numbers for legislators and the governor to make their decision with the budget. Speaking of the budget and the governor's office, Governor Brown has touted the state's fiscal recovery and credits a lot of that to the passage of Proposition 30, the temporary sales and income tax increase passed by voters in 2012. Looking back on it, do you think Prop 30 was the right move at the right time for the state?
Well, having not being in the seat at the time and really not having the opportunity to assess all the different options, it's a little hard to say in hindsight. And, you know, as I've traveled around the state, I've certainly talked with so many small businesses, many of which were impacted with that tax increase, because the vast majority of small businesses are organized in such a way that they were the ones most severely impacted by the tax increases. So, I think everyone that I've talked to is kind of at the place where, like, okay, it happened for the temporary period of time. They're very concerned about those taxes becoming permanent. And so, should I be elected in November, there's so many things that I will immediately want to jump into, but I know over the next couple of years we'll have a thorough analysis and debate over what the future of those temporary taxes should look like.
There's already some talk about extending those. The new Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon has talked about the possibility of doing that. But just to clarify on what you said, did you support Proposition 30 in 2012? Did you vote for it?
No, you know what? I wasn't on the record in any way on Prop 30, and I didn't vote for it.
You've had some big wins as mayor in Fresno, turning around the city's finances. The unemployment rate in the city is down. There have also been some defeats. Measure G is one of them, and the way that played out last year. Also, the city's water rate issue that eventually was pulled back by the council rather than going to a vote, and now you're in the process of a new water rate forum and taking a different approach there, I think it's safe to say. What did you learn from both of those experiences, both Measure G and the water rate increase, and looking back at it, both of those, would you have done anything differently the first time?
Okay, good question. So I think what I've learned overall, not just from my experience with Measure G last spring, but over the last 6 years, it is impossible to do the kind of work that we need to do in the city of Fresno without having a blend of wins and losses. And when you have setbacks and when you feel really strongly about your particular point of view, such as was the case with Measure G, you know, we didn't win. So what were we going to do? We had to pick up and keep going. And what I learned from that is just really reinforcing the importance of continuing to move forward and learning from the losses, but at all times getting up off the mat. It's not whether or not you get punched, knocked out every now and then. You certainly do. The question is, do you get up and do you keep going? And we've done that in the city of Fresno. And today we are reaping the benefits from that kind of outlook and leadership at City Hall. We've paid off our internal debt and our negative fund balances 8 years ahead of schedule. We're well ahead of schedule to meet our reserve targets. The credit rating agencies are now changing their outlooks in our city. You mentioned the unemployment rate is down. Our exports are up 17%. Our GDP grew by more than twice the national average this last year. So, and our city escaped bankruptcy when we're close to the point of being able to return and improve some service levels. So when I consider Measure G a battle, and I certainly think that we're winning, we've won a major war in Fresno when it comes to restoring the city's fiscal health. We certainly lost some battles along the way, but that's the way it goes. And, you know, I know the people on the other side of Measure G obviously felt very strongly about it. And even though I disagreed with them, I can rejoice. They were happy. They won. Okay, fine. Now let's keep moving forward as a community. And, you know, that's the type of approach that I brought to City Hall.
Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen joining us today on Valley Edition. She is a candidate for the Office of State Controller, the November 4th general election. Mayor Swearingen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition, our election special. I'm Joe Moore, a special two-hour program today. Now to talk about the propositions facing voters on November 4th, we have two guests joining us on the phone, Thomas Holyoke, political science professor at Fresno State, and Bill McEwen of the Fresno Bee. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start out, though, with something that's not a proposition and something of interest to local voters in Fresno County, and that's a race for a Superior Court judge that is generating an awful lot of interest, but even more money and contributions that are flowing into this very heated battle between Lisa Gamoyan and Rachel Hill. Bill, have we seen anything like this race in the past in Fresno County? This is really kind of unusual.
Well, we've seen judicial races that have had a lot of sniping before. This isn't unusual. What's unusual here is the amount of money being spent. And last time I calculated it, it was at $560,000 between the two candidates, almost evenly spent or raised, both camps having an equal amount of money. That's very unusual, and I don't know where this is going to end up because both candidates are very determined, and I'm sure they're, you know, spending money as we speak.
There's all sorts of allegations flying about. I think it's interesting, though, because we have this race for Superior Court judge in the general election that is so heated and generating so much money in a race that usually isn't quite as high profile in other years and other judgeships. Also, in the primary, we saw a situation for Fresno County District Attorney where we had also a race that's usually pretty low profile, not a lot of money spent. And that race between Elizabeth Egan and Lisa Sondergaard-Smitkamp was equally hard fought. Professor Holyoke, your thoughts. Is this a new normal for Fresno County campaigns in these races that previously were kind of low profile?
I think this is the new normal just about wherever you are. I mean, over the last 10 years, you've seen positions like this become increasingly competitive. Now, I think there's a a difference between what we saw in the DA's race and the judge's race. The judge's race, that's not really on the political ladder to anywhere in particular. But the DA's race, those kinds of races can now be seen as stepping stones to other kinds of offices. So what you really have are people who are probably interested in having a political career go for those kinds of positions now. I mean, in other words, I would be surprised if Lisa Sundegaard-Smith camp in about 10 years from now didn't consider running for a different kind of office. But the judge's race, that's a little bit more of a surprise. But then again, people are starting to pay more attention to the politics of the judiciary and realizing the extent of judicial power, although in this race the extent of judicial power has been blown way out of proportion for that particular judgeship. But people take it these races more seriously now than they used to.
Back to you, Bill.
Well, I think what's going on here is, overwhelmingly judges are appointed by the governor, and, people that are interested in becoming judges, they have to weigh what their political affiliation is with what the governor's political affiliation is. In addition, they have to submit their name and their resume is poured over and they receive a rating. Are they qualified to be a judge or not? Are they going to be part of that judicial selection process? But when you have an open judgeship where the voters decide, then you get all kinds of candidates running for all kinds of reasons. And I agree with the professor. I mean, the people are running to be a judge, and one of the reasons they're running is it's a really good job.
Yeah.
And, in Lisa Gamoyan's case, I mean, she's been in the trenches for a long, long time dealing with very difficult cases. And I think, in her career, when she was mapping it out, she probably saw it ending with her being on the bench. And so she has that expectation. And then you have Rachel Hill, a very bright person. She's had several jobs, various roles, very varied career. She saw this opportunity, and she really wants it. And we got to remember there were three other people that wanted it too. And the level of sniping, I think it reflects the fact that they both raised so much money, you're going to spend it. And, you're going to have ads saying how great you are, but at some point you're going to have to say how bad the other person is. I mean, it's almost inevitable, and that's what we're seeing happening here. And what's interesting to me is how you have all these judges backing Rachel Hill, and then you have law enforcement backing Lisa Gamoyan. And in the DA's race, if you go back, District Attorney Egan banked a lot on having the endorsement of Sheriff Mims. There had been polling that was done that was very favorable to Sheriff Mims, and polling that, where respondents said, hey, if Sheriff Mims backs somebody, I'm, pretty likely to vote for them. And that didn't work out in that election because Lisa Smitkamp was able to make the case to the voters that Elizabeth Egan had done a so-so job, and it was time for a change. And that's rare, to see a standing and incumbent district attorney challenged in that way, especially successfully. So now we have Lisa Gamoyan, again, banking on the endorsement of law enforcement, and in particular, Sheriff Mims.
We'll see how it turns out November 4th. Moving on to the propositions, I want to start out with the one that's at the top of the ballot. That's Proposition 1, formerly Proposition 43. You may still see some references to that out there somewhere as the legislature and the governor changed the order and the name of those propositions to enhance their profile. This is the $7.12 billion water bond. It is being supported heavily by the governor. In fact, the governor is mainly campaigning for Propositions 1 and 2, and not for himself, at least in his ad buys. This is being billed by many in the Valley as the solution to the drought, the solution to the water problems facing Central California. Bill, is this maybe oversold to some degree?
Well, it's politics, so of course it's oversold. Will it help? Yes, it will help. But if you read it carefully, there's no guarantee that any dams will be built. It says $2.7 billion for water storage. Could be underground storage. It could be dams. There's no guarantee that dams are going to be built. Dams still face the same hurdles that they faced for the last 30 years, 40 years.
And many of the environmental groups that are supporting Proposition 1 do so, saying they're confident that the proposition has been written so as to make any funding for surface storage next to impossible.
Yes. And, the opposition to Proposition 1, it's an interesting mix because you have environmental groups that are against it, and then you have very conservative groups that are joining them. And, their reasons for opposition could be the dams aren't guaranteed, or it could be the general fund's going to have to pay this off. It's an obligation that we shouldn't be taking on.
Moving on to the rainy day fund. Rainy days certainly are something that people in the Valley are looking forward to, but this is a different sort of rainy day. Moving on to Professor Holyoke, your thoughts on Proposition 2 and its potential for winning the approval of California voters?
Well, this is one that's been talked about in various forms for quite some time, and the idea that California needs to have a better kind of financial reserve to basically make it through the dry seasons when it comes to revenue. Indeed, we even have something like that on the books right now. However, what the prospects for this are, they've been getting better, but I believe, according to the last PPIC poll, the Public Policy Institute of California, that at this point, I think a majority is still not in support of Proposition 2, although the percentage of voters that are supporting it does seem to be increasing. It doesn't have the same really high level of support that, say, Proposition 1, the water bond, has right now, but then again, it's not probably seen by voters as nearly as important as the water bond is. So this is one that's we're not quite sure how this is going to end up at this time. But Governor Brown has put nearly as much emphasis on Proposition 2 as he has back on Proposition 1, and certainly more so than he has on his own efforts to be reelected governor.
Well, what I find interesting here is this is the kind of things that seemingly voters have asked for. The voter says we need to budget smarter. We need to budget more like a family would budget. This takes the reserve from 5% to 10%, and yet the reaction's been a lot of apathy on it. So I see this as a test of Governor Brown. Can he bring it home? Because again, a lot of people are undecided on this. If you look at the latest polling, and it'll be up to Governor Brown to sell it in these final days.
Even more,
and this is being seen really as part. This and Proposition 1 are really being seen as the Brown legacy. And these are the things that he, and possibly the one on changing sentencing. This is what he really wants to leave for the state of California on the water bond. He really wants to try to solve these paradoxical problems we have on water between water storage and environmental issues. On Proposition 2, he knows that the state goes through boom-bust cycles because the way we bring in revenue in the state is highly dependent on taxes on upper-income earners. And that means that when things go down really badly, as they did in the last few years. And he's trying to build a very strong reserve to help us get through those times. These are the legacies Brown wants to leave for California. This is what he wants to be remembered for.
Moving on to Proposition 45, one of two propositions on the ballot dealing with health care. And this one is involving the state's insurance commissioner and giving that office more power to approve or reject rates from health insurers. And it's also generating a lot of media attention and a significant number of donations on the against side. According to MapLight, so far the No on Prop 45 side has raised $37.5 million. The Yes on Prop 45, just under $1 million. Bill, this is one of those hard-fought political battles over health care, and the insurance companies are putting quite a bit in.
Yes, and actually I think they'll end up spending more than $50 million in opposition to it. And, the Fresno Bee, we say yes on 45. Newspapers throughout California pretty split on that one. And our position is there are 35, 36 other states that give their insurance commissioner this power. My goodness, we let the insurance commissioner say yay or nay on auto insurance premiums. Shouldn't we allow him to have that same power in regards to rate hikes on health premiums? And we say yes. And opposition says, oh, it's too early. We have to see how the Affordable Care Act works out. But the fact of the matter is these other states, they've been dealing with it. And in this atmosphere, I mean, the no on Proposition 45, I've never seen – well, I shouldn't say I've never seen, but it's one of the most disingenuous campaigns I've ever seen. I mean, they raise arguments that are completely false. They've run TV commercials in which they just make up things.
Specifically, what are you talking about?
Oh, the independent commission that is already setting these rates. There's no such thing as an independent commission. This is a complete fabrication. So I think my advice to voters is just look at what the insurance companies, the stake they have in this. And, you know, if they really were concerned about your health care, hey, they give up $50 million and put it into your health care.
Tom, what does that say about the potential for the passage of Prop 45?
Oh, nothing particularly good. You know, these are the kinds of propositions that when they become really complex and people don't understand what's going on with them, the voters either tend to not vote at all or they tend to vote no, which is certainly would be my advice to voters. If you don't understand a proposition, vote against it.
Moving on to Prop 46, another one dealing with health care, and this is a very interesting one because it is an example of the phenomena that has been called sweeteners that are put into propositions that have maybe a broad overall theme but contain maybe one thing that people can really get behind and then a few other things that are a little more abstract or policy wonkish that might be really at the heart of the measure. This deals with raising the cap on pain and suffering damages awarded in medical malpractice suits, also on drug testing for physicians. Bill, this is another one that is generating a huge outlays, $53 million in the no on Prop 46 campaign, $6 million on the yes side. Where does the B come down on this one?
Well, if you look at it, there are basically only two major papers in California that say yes on 46, and that would be the Fresno Bee and the Modesto Bee. So you can figure out from that the Sacramento Bee disagrees on that. And they say too many moving parts. And also, just in theory, they're opposed to drug testing, you know, in general without a reason to call for a drug test. In other words, you know, why drug test all doctors? Maybe you need to drug test doctors that have problems. Our position is that we drug test pilots. We drug test a lot of people in society, certainly doctors who have your life in their hands deserve to be drug tested. The other part of this is that the malpractice cap, it's $250,000. The other side is saying it's going to, you know, if you raise it to $1 million, oh, all these doctors are going to leave California. They're going to be forced to retire. And the fact of the matter is malpractice insurance is one of the most profitable things that insurance companies do. And basically they're paying out 38 cents on the dollar. And the other thing is the $250,000 cap, that was a long, long time ago. And if you look at, inflation and everything else, it's not reasonable. We think that the cap ought to be raised. I would note that the other side is saying quite often that Prop 46 would take all the limits off the malpractice caps. And again, that's a complete fabrication.
Tom, this is, again, as I said, and as Bill was alluding to an example of a ballot measure that has a number of different moving parts. And the drug testing one, I guess, is the one that's easiest for most California voters to latch onto. Is this something that we have seen a lot of, and are we going to be seeing more of propositions like this in the future?
Well, I think we've already seen lots of propositions like this, propositions that are, that have a lot of different things going on that is really difficult for, voters to really understand. And I think actually the part of this that's the Proposition 46 that's really most interesting is actually the bit about the lawsuit cap, because that's something that a lot of people can fairly easily focus on, even though they may not understand it nearly as well as they think they do, and is really just a regurgitation of a very long-standing battle between the medical community and the trial lawyers groups. And, this is just another way of bringing out the battle that they've been fighting in Sacramento for decades now.
Moving on to some of the last two propositions here. Prop 47, kind of a lower profile than the last two, but this is one that is very important as it deals with criminal justice and criminal sentencing. Bill, what is the essential argument on both sides of this Prop 47?
Well, the argument is that it's sentencing reform, and if it's passed, it will give more people a chance to come back into the community and get on the straight and narrow, so to speak. People talk about the wholesale incarceration of individuals, especially people of color and people from poor communities. And I think there's a valid argument to make for that. At the B, we're opposed to Prop 47, and just on the thinking that we're still going through Assembly Bill 109. Certainly the 58 counties to varying degrees have had trouble implementing that. And while we believe in sentencing reform, one, we think it should be follow an independent, the naming of an independent commission, and we should be looking at everything. And we've long advocated for that. But we think it's too close on the heels of AB 109. And we realize that's probably not a popular stand to take once again. I think the polling shows that it's going to pass.
Tom, years ago, California voters were out in front on this perceived crackdown on crime, passing things like three strikes just a few years ago. More recently, California voters made some amendments to that. Now, Prop 47, another thing that would provide sentencing reform. Is the mood of the California electorate, has it changed significantly when it comes to criminal justice reform?
Well, it certainly seems so, because the pendulum is swinging very much back in favor of essentially the rights of prisoners and stuff, and the feeling that our prisons are way overcrowded now, that really that three strikes was probably severe overkill, and that we have an awful lot of people in prison who are we'd probably be better served as a society. There was a better chance for these people to be rehabilitated outside of prison, and that they're in prisons and under sentences that are really not warranted given what they did. And this is really an opportunity for California to straighten out a lot of the messes it's created in its criminal justice system.
Yeah, we're up against the clock here. We have time for the last proposition, and that would be Proposition 48, and one that is certainly of interest to local voters, as this would allow the North Fork Rancheria of Mono Indians to build a new casino away from their traditional land in North Fork and build it on Highway 99 just north of Madera. It is going before voters statewide. The opponents of this measure say that it would set a dangerous precedent to allow off-reservation gaming and other communities. The supporters are mainly the tribe themselves. If you look at the opponents, though, big money flowing from two factions, and that would be the potential competition for this new casino. Bill, your thoughts on how this fits into this, I'm going to just say, crazy world of Indian gaming. What's going on right now in Central California with the Chukchansi mess and everything else?
Well, I think the situation at Chukchansi probably doesn't help, the yes on 48 people, certainly not in the Central Valley. I don't know how much the news has gotten out about the situation with Chukchansi statewide. But basically, if you build there, this is not what California voters approved when they, gave the thumbs up to what is called Class 3 gaming or Las Vegas-style gaming. If this proposition is defeated with a no vote, I mean, they're still going to build there now, but it's not going to be a Las Vegas-style casino. It'll be more of, the bingo gambling hall-type card room. And you can bet that they'll mount a legal fight also challenging the outcome on this. So a lot remains to be seen about what's going to happen there in Madera County.
Tom, any final thoughts on Prop 48?
Prop 48 is if this goes through and allows
that's a good term. That's a good term.
We're probably almost certainly going to see other efforts to do just exactly the same sort of thing, and maybe that's not in a way such a bad thing. Maybe a little competition in India casino gaming isn't such a bad thing, especially given the terrible way we've treated Native Americans in the past. Maybe this is something they deserve.
Again, Tom Holyoke joining us from Fresno State, political science professor, one of our political analysts here on Valley Edition, and Bill McEwen of the Fresno Bee giving us their thoughts on the propositions facing voters. Election Day is November 4th. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I figured out at a young age that if I wanted to conquer the world, I had to understand it.
I'm Michelle Norris.
NPR helped me understand the world, even though I was growing up in the Midwest. NPR took me places that I would never get to while I was in college, or at least that I didn't have access to. It introduced me to people that were outside of my world. I developed a certain kind of muscular knowledge that I didn't get in other places. And I say that even as a working journalist. For years when I worked in print and in television, there was something special about NPR. And anyone who listens to it knows it. You know it when you hear it. You know it when you think about it long after you flipped off the radio. Something you heard lives in you, and you're still thinking about it as you're falling off to sleep. You're thinking about it when you're on your run, even though you're listening to your iPod, but you're thinking about that conversation that you heard this morning on Morning Edition, or you're thinking about the Car Talk guys and how they made you laugh. You're doing something else, but that's still in you. And once you've experienced it, to know it is to love it. And to love it is to get to the point that you can't live without it. And if you know it, and if you love it, and if you've experienced it, it's worth supporting.
Become a member of Valley Public Radio online today at kvpr.org. You're listening to Valley Public Radio, NPR for Central California, KVPR Fresno, KPRX Bakersfield, and online at kvpr.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at KVPR. Stay tuned for more of our Valley Edition 2-hour election special.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
Listening to a special 2-hour Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We'll return to our election coverage in just a bit, but first, a diversion to the outdoors. It's been said that our national parks are treasures that belong to all Americans. Well, in recent weeks, one artist has been on a nationwide quest to document her travels to these locations of immense natural beauty. And like many, she shared photos of her journey online, from Zion and Bryce National Parks to Yosemite and Sequoia Kings Canyon. But her photos weren't of the park's natural beauty. Instead, they documented her graffiti art painted onto rock walls, in some cases actually showing her in the act of defacing America's grandest scenic vistas. The photos on Instagram and Tumblr eventually drew the attention of our next guest and then became a national story. Joining us now on the phone is Casey Schreiner. He is the founder and editor of Modern Hiker. Casey, welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Tell me about exactly how authorities first became aware of this graffiti artist.
Well, I became aware of it through a friend who had posted a link to a Reddit thread on her Facebook page. I hopped in. This was around Tuesday morning. And at that time, there were maybe only 10 or 11 people in that Reddit thread. They had found one of her Instagram images, and they were trying to figure out where it was taken and if anyone else had seen similar paintings or if someone knew who she was. From there, I immediately hopped onto all of her social media feeds, started screen grabbing everything, saving as much information as I could, and I had the first post about it on Tuesday, late morning, early afternoon, and from there, the story really just took off. It became very active both on my website and on that original Reddit thread. People were finding more images that she had done. People were able to correctly identify the parks that she was in, and in some cases, the specific locations on the exact trails that she had left these paintings. And then from there, a special National Park Service investigator got involved in a Reddit thread and started taking information and reaching out to other people as well for more.
So you essentially have this woman who was going around to national parks throughout the country painting her artwork on rock walls and other natural formations throughout the park, and then documenting them on the internet.
Yeah, so basically it seemed like this person was basically going to all the national parks or a lot of the national parks in the western United States and leaving either paintings or in some cases Sharpie marker drawings on rock walls. There was an instance of her or a photo of her in Joshua Tree actually climbing over some pictographs. And I think in one case in what appears to be Canyonlands National Park, you can actually see her holding a Sharpie marker, drawing this image of a woman in a scarf smoking a cigarette, which seemed to be a motif that she used several times on her trip. And then, of course, she signed all of her paintings, Creepy Tings, which was her Instagram handle as well.
Do we know anything about her motivation, why someone would do this?
At this point, we do not know anything about her motivation. I have not had any contact with the person or her family. I would have to imagine that the Park Service investigators have at least reached out at this point. It's been a couple days. And I know, unfortunately, that the bad side of a social media investigation like this is that sometimes you get people who are a little overzealous and they'll post personal information or in some cases reach out themselves, which really doesn't help anyone in this situation.
Exactly. There's some people on the internet who have identified the individual. We have not confirmed that identity, so we will not share that. But this situation did raise an interesting question. I saw some people saying, well, did she know that this was wrong? Is this just some very misinformed person? And I've seen others say, no, she did know that this was wrong. She actually used acrylic paint, and she said, oh, I'm a bad person for doing that, I guess, or
right.
Something to that effect. Can you talk about that?
Right. There's one instance of a conversation on one of her Instagram photos where apparently one of her friends or followers asked her, hey, are you doing these things in chalk or acrylic? With the idea being that chalk, even though it would still technically be graffiti and still a crime, at the very least it would wash away in the next rain. And then she responded, no, I'm using acrylics. Her friend responded with a frowny face. And then she responded with, yeah, I know I'm a bad person.
Wow. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated incident, though, in the national parks, maybe not to this extent and documented quite as well on social media. But park rangers and others have had to deal with this in national and state parks across the country, have they not?
Right. No, that's very correct. And one of the things I'm trying to refocus this issue on is, yes, we have this instance of one person who allegedly took a photo spree of her, graffiti trip across the western United States. But not everyone leaves so rich a social media trail. And graffiti is a problem in these parks. It has been before and it will be in the future. There was an instance last year in Saguaro National Park where people were spray painting and vandalizing the namesake cacti of that park and then putting it on Instagram. Of course, there was that instance in Goblin Valley State Park in Utah last year, which is a state park, so it's a little bit different. But there were the two Boy Scout leaders who toppled over some hoodoos that they thought were a danger to hikers. And those guys ended up only getting fined less than $2,000 apiece. And I think they had their Boy Scout title stripped, but that was it. However, there is hope that the Park Service is going to take a firm stance on this. There was a more recent issue of a photographer in Canyonlands National Park at Mesa Arch who wanted to improve the light, so he set up a Duraflame log underneath the arch. And he was caught and fined a pretty hefty fee for doing that.
What sort of punishment or what sort of fines, penalties could someone like this face?
I'm not sure the exact penalties, but I do know that, defacing a national park is a federal offense. So I believe that there's a certain amount of fine per instance. It may be $1,000 per instance and 5 years incarceration per instance. But, of course, that's all sliding scale and depends on, whether or not the person comes forward, whether she cooperates, and a variety of other factors.
And what has the response been like from your readers? I know many of those in the outdoor community practice the leave no trace principle. Has this helped to raise awareness of these sorts of things? Does this maybe have a net benefit effect in some way?
Well, you know what? I'm really hoping that this has a net benefit in some way. I actually wrote a follow-up to my original story just because the outcry was so strong and so negative. People who go to these national parks really develop an intense personal connection with them. And when you have that sort of a feeling about a place and you see someone defacing it, it really kind of feels like you've been punched in the gut. So I totally understand that people are upset and they want to vent. And, the first place to do that is a comment thread. But a more constructive way to vent that frustration is to actually, you know, donate to one of these parks. And it doesn't have to be a national park. This is, you know, national forests have this problem, state parks have this problem, local parks have this problem, and every one of those parks needs help. So if you can volunteer your time or your money or even just bringing someone who maybe doesn't think that this is a big story, that this is a big deal, maybe someone who thinks that, oh, it's some girl who painted something on a rock, what's the fuss? If you can bring that person out to a park and let them experience it for themselves, then maybe they'll understand, you know, for themselves in their own personal sense why this is so important to people.
Are authorities working on cleaning this up now at this point? What's your understanding of the status of these works?
As far as I know, it's going to take some professional restoration to fix these. She did use acrylic paint, which can be very difficult to get off. And in some cases, she may have been near Native American artifacts or pictographs or petroglyphs. So those require extra special care. I don't know exactly what the Park Service investigators are doing, but as far as I know, she hasn't officially been named as a suspect yet. And I would guess that they're probably trying to pinpoint the location of all these images to take some photographic evidence of them for themselves so that they have it if they do need to press charges.
Again, we've been talking with Casey Schreiner. He is the founder and editor of Modern Hiker, helped to break the story about the woman who was traveling the western United States to national parks and creating her own artworks on some very significant national landmarks and national parks. Authorities are working to identify the individual and to repair the damage right now. Casey Schreiner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to a special two-hour broadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Later on this hour, Betty Yee joins us. We'll talk to the Democrat who's running for the Office of State Controller and find out what she says about Ashley Swearengen's record in the city of Fresno and how she responds to Swearengen's attacks on her record. And given that both Yee and Swearengen are running for statewide office, our next story is rather appropriate. On the surface, women look like they're doing well in California politics. The assembly leader is a woman, as is the assembly minority leader. And women played crucial roles this year in passing groundwater legislation and the water bond voters will decide on in November. But a closer look reveals the situation is much shakier. In the final part of our series on women in California politics, Up Against the Ceiling, Capital Public Radio's Katie Orr looks at the state of women in the legislature.
It's a Saturday afternoon in San Diego, and Democratic Assembly Speaker Toni Atkins sits in the courtyard of a popular neighborhood restaurant. She's holding what amounts to office hours at a picnic table. And she takes a few minutes out to reflect on efforts to increase diversity in the legislature.
We spend a lot of time talking about how to make that happen for ethnic groups and LGBT and Asian and all those issues. But I think people are sort of not thinking about the gender diversity and the fact that we are seriously losing women.
I, Correa, De Leon, I, DeSaunye.
Of the 120 seats in the legislature, 32 are currently held by women. Atkins expects a loss of at least one woman after the November election. And with term limits and the power of incumbency, if that loss isn't made up for in the next election, she says it could be a decade before the legislature could get close to gender parity. Democratic Senator Holly Mitchell shares Atkins' concerns.
Again, this sort of snuck up on us that a number of key women who were former state legislators didn't go away. They're still on the scene. They transitioned to Congress. And so it took a minute before people began to realize that we were losing real numbers because they kept seeing these same names on the scene.
Mitchell is also concerned about the racial makeup of the women serving in the Senate. She's one of just three female minorities and just the fourth female black senator since statehood. Mitchell predicts changing that won't be easy.
Everyone will buy into the rhetoric around the value of diversity and the unique perspective women bring to decision making. But, you know, no one wants to share power. Power has to be taken.
Yet Democratic Senator Hannah Beth Jackson says, in her experience, women don't come to Sacramento to gain influence the way some men do.
There are always exceptions, but generally the women come up here interested in the policy. They're not interested in the power.
She says women are typically drawn to the state legislature after noticing a problem within their community. Assembly Republican leader Kristen Olson says she first became interested in running for her seat while on the Modesto City Council.
The time that I ran back in 2010, our biggest threat as a city was the state of California. Those were the times of deep budget cuts, and the state kept balancing its budget on the backs of cities, counties, and schools.
It was a big decision for Olson to run, in part because she and her husband have three small children. She says she knew many men running for the legislature who had children the same age or younger than her own.
And never once at any of the forums we attended or in any of the newspaper articles did I ever see them asked, are they going to be able to do it and still be a good father? And so at first that was very frustrating because I was asked that constantly.
Olson says she eventually decided to acknowledge people's concerns and reassure them her children would be taken care of. And she says it's important for women, especially mothers, to let other women know that it is possible to serve and still fulfill all your other responsibilities.
Particularly young women who are just now in college or in high school and thinking about what they want to do as they grow older, to not set barriers in front of themselves and to realize what they can do instead of constantly thinking about limits.
Young women could be key to creating gender parity. 75% of women in the legislature first served on city councils or boards of supervisors, often training grounds for Sacramento. Still, women make up less than 30% of elected officials in state, county, and city offices. And Speaker Atkins acknowledges that many women, including her, have to be asked to run.
So I'm asking, run. Run, women, run.
I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Speaking of women in California politics, the race for state controller is one that pits two women, Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, a Republican, and State Board of Equalization member Betty Yee, a Democrat. The normally low-profile race has gained quite a bit of attention this year. In the June primary, Swearingen actually finished first, despite Democrats' huge edge in voter registration in California. That's largely due to the top two primary system that pitted two popular Democrats against each other. Betty Yee wound up in second place, finishing ahead of John Perez. But now as we approach the general election, most polls show Yee with a significant lead over the Fresno mayor. Last hour we heard from Swearingen. Now, Betty Yee joins us on Valley Edition. Betty, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be with you.
A lot of people here in the Central Valley are familiar with your opponent, but maybe don't know as much about you or your personal story and background. How do you think your background shaped you into the person you are today and the path you've taken into public service?
Sure. Well, I am very proud of my background. I am the second oldest of six children born to immigrant parents, and my really foray into politics was serving as a spokesperson for my parents who didn't speak English as they ran a laundry and dry cleaning business in San Francisco. So their best employees were the six children, and I was responsible for all of the financial transactions of the business between the business and vendors and banks and government. And this really was what got me interested in politics, was, you know, just being a voice for someone. And obviously my finance experience just became more and more honed through my formal training. I am a Cal Berkeley grad. I have my master's in public administration, native of San Francisco, and I'm serving in the public and doing public service because I'm just very, very grateful for all the wonderful opportunities I've had as a native Californian, and wish that for every Californian who wants to work hard and succeed.
I've heard you described as a policy wonk, and I think it's been used in a positive way. How do you respond to that? Do you view yourself as a policy wonk?
I do. At the end of the day, I think what the public really wants from their government is for things to work. And one of the things I do take great pride in is, even though I am a finance expert, at the end, what I really like to do is to apply the finance discipline to things that help government programs work and deliver for the public. And it's always been my eye on what the goal is in terms of the role of government, and that's to facilitate things for the residents of the state. And hopefully we can continue to do that.
And, of course, you served in the administration of Governor Gray Davis and now on the Board of Equalization. Moving on to the controller's race now, there is no incumbent in this race, but for 8 years now, John Chung has held this office. You've had an interesting perspective as a member of the Board of Equalization and working with him and his office. I'd be
curious to hear your critique of his performance on the job. What do you think he's done well? What do you think are issues that the Comptroller's Office could do a better job on if you were in that chair?
Sure. I think he's done a good job with respect to really elevating the transparency of the office. And by that, I mean trying to inform the public on a regular basis about our revenue situation and whether our receipts are keeping track with projections, and also looking at making very, very public on a database the public salaries that are being drawn by workers at the local level as well as the state level. And these are all positions that are funded by taxpayer dollars. And so from the perspective of transparency, very, very high marks, and I want to continue with those legacies. On the other hand, I think, and this is not unique to the Comptroller's Office, but I think for state agencies generally, we don't and have not been able to incorporate the use of technology in a robust way that really increases our efficiency. And this is an area that I really want to focus some attention to, because I do believe that certainly operating mining the store, if you will, for the state of California requires having all of the best tools to help us do a good job.
The Office of State Comptroller isn't the highest profile one in Sacramento, but it's an important office, and it's a multifaceted one. You would sit on a number of different boards. I want to talk about a few of those today as we talk about your agenda for the Office of State Comptroller. One of those responsibilities is sitting on the boards of retirement systems, CalPERS and CalSTRS.
Yes.
How satisfied are you with the health of CalPERS right now and the future of defined benefit pension programs, not just for those already in them, but for the future moving forward?
Well, I think to the extent that the investments of the pension funds are very closely tied to the performance of the market, there's always risk and volatility. And what I would do as a member of the CalPERS board is to ensure that we can minimize that as much as possible, taking a very active stance with respect to how we allocate our assets, trying to reduce investment costs, but also looking at how we're going to draw down that unfunded liability, which is sitting at over $100 billion right now. And I want to applaud the governor and the legislature for taking that on with respect to the state teachers' retirement system by enacting a revised funding formula that has the state and school districts and the teacher members all paying more into the system to fully satisfy the unfunded liability over a three-decade period. And so we have to have this long-term vision about how we work down the liability in order to be able to pay all of the benefits that our workers have earned. On the other hand, we can do much more in terms of reducing costs and being sure that we are making good investments.
Earlier this year, the CalPERS board drew some criticism from certain quarters in the media and others in public service for their decision to approve 99 special pay exemptions for employees that could result in them obtaining higher pensions, things like the parking citation premium for employees assigned to read parking meters and write tickets. And these are things that are at the local level that local governments have agreed as increases in base pay, but that can be used to obtain a higher pension. That took a good bit of criticism from some out there who follow Sacramento. Would you have voted to approve those exemptions?
First of all, let me just say the role of the board is to essentially implement legislation. And going back and having read the statutes that facilitated these various types of pay, the decision of the CalPERS board was a right decision, and I would have voted for it because that our role at that point is to implement the law by putting together the rules for that. Where the stopgap is really at the collective bargaining table, and to the extent that local governments are offering what we call pensionable compensation in these different ways, this is all part of negotiations that could take place at the bargaining table in terms of which of these types of compensation would be subject to service credits through the pension system. So two steps to this process, but I view the CalPERS board decision as one where they were taking on the role of essentially putting the rules in place to implement the legislation.
You mentioned the collective bargaining process. Your opponent has somewhat of a contentious up and down relationship with organized labor. Many labor organizations are supporting your campaign. How would you characterize your relationship with organized labor?
Well, I would say I have an open relationship. I've not always been on their side, but certainly it's been a cooperative relationship. And I will say that over the time that the state was undergoing severe budget reductions with the Great Recession. We did have our bargaining units at the Board of Equalization go to the bargaining table, and they really did not want to see their members being laid off and furloughed. And so we encouraged them to go to the table if they could make concessions to do so. And in fact, they did. And they led the rest of the bargaining units of the state in essentially taking a pay cut, contributing more to their retirement. And this was a way that we were able to at least stave off layoffs and furloughs. And for our agency, that was important because we generate revenue for the state of California. And so we've had an open relationship, and certainly when we look at things like becoming more efficient that may create a threat for public employees, we're very, very open in terms of our communication about what it is we're trying to achieve. And more times than not, they're part of the solution, and they are helping us identify efficiencies.
One of the other things that you've talked about a good bit during the campaign is the environment, climate change, and those things. One of the lesser known elements of the state controller's office is you would sit on the board of the State Lands Commission. What do you think the controller could do or should do when it comes to issues like climate change, like fracking? You've talked about that. Where do you see your role there being, in addition to the legislature, in addition to Dogger and those other agencies that are out there doing things in that area?
Sure, sure. Well, to the extent that we have the stewardship responsibility over state lands and our waterways and natural resources on the Lands Commission, it seems to me that we should be modeling at the state level what it means to be responsible environmental stewards. So in other words, if we're going to be mandating businesses and individuals in California to be good environmental stewards, whether it's about water conservation and reuse, whether it's about waste reduction, whether it's about energy efficiency, the state really ought to be modeling what that looks like so that it becomes an ethic for how we live rather than a burden. And this is really where I think we have a tremendous opportunity to start a long-term conversation about how we create the jobs to facilitate that. That the jobs that will produce the technologies, the services, the products that will facilitate us being good environmental stewards really can be established here in California. We've got the innovation. We certainly can start teaching our young people about being prepared for these jobs. And so I look at it as a very, very long-term effort about how we promote environmental stewardship as a state and also down to the individual level.
One of the other things that has been a big story in California over the last 2 years is Proposition 30. It's been credited with helping to restore the state's fiscal health after voters approved the temporary sales and income tax increase back in 2012. The new Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon has said he is open to extending Proposition 30. Would you support extending those temporary tax increases into the future beyond what voters had approved in 2012?
Well, I think an assessment will have to be made in this next term about whether the economy has recovered enough to generate the revenues that these temporary tax increases did produce. And I think the governor and the legislature will be making that assessment. And should they decide to extend these temporary tax increases, my hope would be that we can have a very open, honest discussion about tax reform. That I don't think the best way to provide for budget stability going forward is extending those temporary tax increases. In fact, I think we ought to be looking at the underlying structure of our tax system because it is not sustainable when we have a shrinking base that's paying the sales tax, and we also have a very, very small base that's responsible for paying the overwhelming majority of our income taxes. And so I don't see how that's sustainable, and I do hope that the decision point about extending the Proposition 30 tax increases will provide an opportunity to talk about tax reform.
Does that mean Prop 13 is on the table in your view?
Well, potentially. I mean, it depends on how open we are with how wide open we crack open the tax system. And if it's a complete comprehensive tax reform discussion, Prop 13 could be on the table.
Again, if you just joined us today, we're talking with Betty Yee. She is a candidate for the Office of State Controller, facing off against Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen in the November 4th general election. Of course, this is a campaign, and in campaigns, candidates like to make claims about their opponents. Your opponent has a website that attacks your record serving in the Davis administration back in the late 90s and early 2000s, saying that you're at least partly responsible for the huge growth in general fund spending that the state saw in those years, and also the huge drop in revenue that the state experienced around the time that the dot-com bubble burst. You've also made similar attacks against Mayor Swearengen for her performance with the city of Fresno, saying that she failed to live up to her promises of making the city a better place to live, and blamed her for soaring deficits and unbalanced budgets, which she says she inherited a bad situation when she took office in 2009. Aren't both of those claims a little bit, I guess, silly might not be the best word, but I understand you're in a campaign and both of you are trying to get traction, but there seems like from an outside perspective, there's a lot of macro issues going on in both of your cases.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's true. However, what I would say sets the two sets of arguments apart is the mayor has been has been leading the city. And in her own comprehensive annual financial report, the findings have shown some significant fiscal setbacks. Now, the city is rebounding a bit now, which I'm pleased to see. And but in terms of some of the strategies for how budgets were balanced over the last period of years, they are not the kinds of things that I would consider to be wise, sustainable decisions. And she's made some tough decisions, albeit that really when you look at the fact that you've got existing negative fund balances, no cushion for operating deficits, the overall credit rating is improving now, but it was very, very poor up until this time. So, I mean, she is claiming to be the elected executive, and yet when you look at the strategies that were taken to balance the budget, they are not good, sound fiscal strategies and controls that were in place. I did serve in the Davis administration as the state budget director, and my role there was really to essentially prepare the options for how we close a budget shortfall. And as you know, any budget process is subject to politics, and we had the governor and the legislature negotiating the budget every year during the downturn. And frankly, the drop in revenues occurred because of a really lackluster stock market performance. So we have huge swings in terms of our revenues being much less than what we had anticipated. And we essentially did try to build the reserve during that time, but also a lot of frustration with respect to cuts and lack of tax relief. And so the decisions become political. But my role at that time was to be independent, to come in with a list of options for how we could really balance the budget and to address the shortfall. And so I do think the blame is not properly placed. And as I look at it, this is all about having the deep fiscal knowledge to be able to propose solutions that will provide for sound fiscal stability.
With those years in mind, as the way the California economy has these boom and bust cycles, how concerned are you right now about the volatility in the way that California's revenues are so much tied to those massive gains in the stock market and right. This the potential for the future moving ahead from there?
Sure, sure. Well, very concerned. And because, as I said, the budget process is subject to a lot of politics and a lot of give and take, it's very important that we don't find ourselves in another situation where we're building a massive budget deficit because we're spending essentially one-time revenue. Voters will have an opportunity to look at Proposition 2 on the ballot this coming November as well, which does establish a rainy day fund to specifically address putting away some of that one-time revenue, some of that stock market-related income, so that we can build a rainy day fund for when we do have downturns in the future. And as a controller, I welcome that tool. While it may hamper some legislative flexibility, it certainly is a wise tool for sound fiscal planning.
We've been talking with Betty Yee, candidate for state controller. She's currently on the State Board of Equalization. Betty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure.
Stay with us on this special Valley Edition election preview. We'll be back in just a moment and talk to another candidate for statewide office. Republican Secretary of State candidate Pete Peterson will join us. That's coming up on FM 89.
There are lots of places that you can turn for the latest blips of news information. And in fact, there are more and more outlets that don't really generate any new information. They don't report anything. They repackage what is already there, which they think is true and might be relevant or might be not. But gosh, it's new. What public radio does is try to make sense of that. Often what we're trying to do is slow down the news cycle rather than speed it up. We're trying to figure out what happened last week that really matters today. And I think we're able to do that in a different way because we are supported by listeners. Most other news outlets are dependent on advertising, and that's fine. But in the end, you're doing the bidding of the people who pay the bills. And it's better if some, or most, actually, of the bills are paid by the people who consume the news. It's enlightened self-interest in a way. When you contribute to public radio, you're contributing to yourself. You're contributing to your own information. You can get it for free, but it's actually better to pay for it because you want it to be for you. And so when you're making a contribution, you're doing something that I think improves your own life, and you're actually able to see the money come back to you in the form of information that is just done a little differently and that you can rely on maybe a little bit more.
Become a member of Valley Public Radio online today at kvpr.org. You're listening to a special two-hour Valley Edition election preview. I'm Joe Moore. You may recall a few weeks ago on our program, we talked to State Senator Alex Padilla. He's one of the authors of the new statewide plastic bag ban. But we didn't just talk about that new law. We also talked about the office of Secretary of State. Padilla, a Democrat, is facing off against Republican Pete Peterson for that office, which supervises California elections and also many business functions throughout the state. Yesterday, Peterson visited our studios during a trip to the Valley. Here's our conversation.
Pete Peterson joins us now in our studio. Pete, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Pete, you have a great job at Pepperdine University running a civic engagement program there.
Yep.
You're running to be Secretary of State. Why would somebody do that?
Well, that's a question I get asked a lot. But I have to say, you know, it's a very good question in the sense that really it's my work at Pepperdine that I think uniquely prepares me for this run. The work I do at Pepperdine, I head up an institute there called the Davenport Institute for Public Engagement. And while I do teach a class there to master's candidates in public policy, about 90% of the work I do is outside the classroom, training with or consulting government officials around the state and how to do better public engagement. And it's been through that work that I actually got to know our Secretary of State, Deborah Bowen, several years ago. But I also got to meet other secretaries of state in other states and really just saw an office here in California, the Secretary of State's office, that I thought was really underperforming. And nobody from the party or anybody came and tapped me on the shoulder. I just saw an opportunity to really transform an office with my experience. And I just threw my hat in the ring.
Most of the people who wind up running for Secretary of State use it on something of the stepping stone to higher office.
Yeah.
At least it's part of this. One of the things you do in Sacramento, you run for Secretary of State.
Right.
You haven't run for office before.
Right.
Did you ever envision yourself taking this step before?
I didn't really. And it really grew organically because of the work I've been doing at the Institute. As I said, I've gotten to meet our Secretary of State on a couple of occasions through the work I do in promoting civic participation. But at the same time, I've also got to know secretaries of state in other states. And just seeing an office that I thought really could be doing so much more to promote greater civic engagement, while at the same time, my wife is a small business owner, and she's told me on more than a few occasions how difficult the office has been to work with as a small business owner.
So what is the office doing wrong?
Well, a couple things. On the voter engagement side, California was actually recently ranked by the nonpartisan Pew Center on the states as 49th out of 50 states in how we conduct elections. It's something they call their Election Performance Index, and they use 15 different metrics to evaluate a state's election system. And so on everything from using technology to inform voters to how we count our absentee ballots to how we engage our military serving overseas, California came in at 49th out of 50 states. And so a lot of work needs to be done really in transforming an office that has not used technology well, both inside the voting booth and outside the voting booth. And I think I bring that unique background in technology to the office. But on the business engagement side, there are also several problems there. You're not able to register your business online in California. There are a lot of different what you would call paperwork filing responsibilities that the Secretary of State's office has, that when you look at other states like a Nevada, for example, or a Arizona, you're able to do so much of this work online, as with so many other things we can do in our what you might call private sector lives. But the Secretary of State's office is actually quite antiquated in its processes and technology in engaging both voters and businesses.
You talk so much about civic engagement. The talk around this election, one of the common themes that we hear is a prediction of rather low turnout.
Yeah.
What do you think California is doing wrong to have this sort of projection of low turnout? We already saw a record low turnout in the primary.
Right. Well, I think there are a couple things, and this is not to dismiss the importance of that, but at least to put it in context. California was not the only state in America to see record low turnout in the primary. There were actually several other states. And in part, why I made the career decision, I used to be in the private sector 10 years ago. I made a career decision to move into this field of civic engagement because I really do believe that we are seeing a crisis of citizenship, Joe. That not only in the United States, but especially here in California, quite frankly, government is not doing a very, very good job of informing and engaging us. This is something I've seen throughout the state, mostly at the more local government level, but I certainly can see this at the state level. And we as citizens, quite frankly, are not taking our responsibility seriously enough. I've worked in places like Bell, California, which many of your listeners may know, suffered a significant corruption scandal there. And one of the things I learned from working in that situation after the whole scandal broke apart was just how few residents there knew what was going on in their own city hall, while at the same time, the leaders of that city were also doing everything they could to hold out the citizens who wanted to get involved and engaged and informed. So you see what I would call a broken relationship between citizens and government. And to address that problem, what I've done in my own life is really try to work with governments to help them use technology to better inform their citizens. But certainly in making this run for Secretary of State, I'm trying to make a statement that there should be people inside government that are trying to actively inform and engage their residents in a nonpartisan way.
You just were one of the two finalists in the recent top two primary. So I guess this is a question that you may not be an entirely unbiased participant in. But what are your thoughts on California's top two primary? This is something that a lot of groups from groups that have a partisan lean to also nonpartisan groups supported as a good reform for California. We're now seeing it play out. One of the things that people talked about, well, this is going to get more people interested because we're going to get different sorts of candidates.
Right.
Do you think it's playing out like people predicted? And what were your thoughts on it then and now?
Very good question. So I have been a supporter of it. I was in the beginning and I continue to be. But that's different than saying, is it working out as everybody thought that it would to increase civic engagement? And obviously, the data just does not support that. Now, to address that, I think actually the Secretary of State's responsibility should be out there from a bully using their bully pulpit to make sure that Californians know that there are unique opportunities presented to them in civic engagement because of the top two. So, for example, I live in Santa Monica and I'm a Republican. There are not many Republicans in Santa Monica. And there have been many instances when I've voted for a local state assembly or a state Senate candidate when I may have voted for the Republican in the primary, but I knew when that translated over to the general election when we had party primaries, and I knew there was really slim to no chance that a Republican was going to make it through. In a couple elections now, I have now voted for a Democrat because we've had a Democrat on Democrat race in the assembly. We do now have one in my local district for state Senate, who I think is a better choice than the other Democrat on the ballot. And in that, I'm actually feeling better engaged as a Republican voting in Santa Monica because I know my vote's going to make more of a difference because on a Democrat versus Democrat race, or if you're a Democrat living in a predominantly Republican district, the candidates are going to have to seek out your vote. And what we've seen in many of these same party races is they tend to be extremely close. And I think, for example, in the state Senate race in my hometown, in my home district, that's going to be a very tight race. And one of the Democrats at least, is going to have to appeal to Republican voters. And I know my vote is going to make a difference there.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, our guest is Pete Peterson. He is the Republican candidate for Secretary of State in the upcoming general election. One of the big issues that we hear, not just in California, but throughout the country right now and that continues to pop up is voting rights. There's been a lot of stories in the last few years. In fact, right now there is a big voting rights controversy in Georgia as there's some dispute over a number of voter registration efforts and whether those registration forms have been lost or properly counted. California is maybe in a slightly different state than some of those states in the South, but voting rights issues still are of importance to many here in California. We've seen polling places change and a number of other things that folks in a lot of traditionally underserved communities or underrepresented communities have raised questions. What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court's decision, the federal Supreme Court's decision on the Federal Voting Rights Act and how it applies to California and what California can do to safeguard voting for all?
Well, I think the decision made on the Supreme Court still allows significant protections for those that feel that they are being disenfranchised. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is still in effect, and I still think it does provide significant protections. At the same time, as someone who's been involved in the civic engagement field for the last 8 years, it has always been my priority to make sure that all people are better involved and informed. And I've worked in communities where people have been either intentionally or certainly have felt like they've been disenfranchised. And my work has really been about making sure that they're involved and informed, particularly in minority communities, particularly for many for whom English is not a native language. And you have to make preparations for that, right? You have to make sure that ballot materials and voter information materials are translated in a way that and provided in a way that voters for whom English is not a native language, that they're informed. And if there's one thing I've learned on the campaign trail, Joe, especially speaking with leaders in various ethnic communities, is that the broader state of our translation services in ballot materials is actually fairly woeful. And I don't mean that just for Latinos, but especially in the Asian American community. I've spoken with several leaders there that have said, Pete, the translations not only of the ballot, but also the voter information guide, A, it's difficult to access. Right there, it's difficult to find those materials in their language and have that sent to them on time. But at the same time, the translations themselves are poor. So one of the things that I propose is we really do a top-to-bottom review of the translations that we are performing, both on the ballots themselves as well as the voter information materials.
We just recently passed the deadline for Californians to register for to vote. So if you haven't, it's already too late, or to change your location. But one of the things that some Democrats talk about is changing that and doing things like same-day voter registration, registering to vote on the day of the election. Where do you stand on issues like that? Would it expand the civic engagement of the population, or were there problems there?
Well, PPIC actually did a very interesting study last year, Public Policy Institute of California, in which they looked at a couple different voter reforms to look at other states and see what the impact has been on civic engagement. And for the states that have moved to same-day registration, they only saw actually a very minor bump up in civic engagement. The reform that they saw had the greatest impact is allowing what they called election day plus 3 days to receive in absentee ballots. Something we want to make sure that your listeners know, your absentee ballot is not like your tax return, right? For the tax return, we're able to get it back on April 15th, and as long as you have it postmarked, you're fine. That is not the case for your absentee ballot. It needs to be received by election day. Now, at the next cycle, SB 29 was passed in the legislature this past year, which will allow election day plus 3 days for the receipt of your absentee ballots. And you could see a couple percent uptick because we do actually throw out more absentee ballots than any other state in the country. And the largest reason why we do throw them out is because they're received after election day. So I support that. Same-day registration, I also support, and it is the law. It was passed in 2012, but it can only take effect after we complete what I call my top priority as being our next Secretary of State, is overseeing the transition from our county-by-county voter roll system to a single statewide voter database. And the law which was written in 2012 and Governor Brown signed, states that same-day registration can only take place after the voter database is completed. So I will hopefully have an opportunity to oversee that as the next Secretary of State.
You're running for the office of Secretary of State, obviously, right, as a Republican.
Right.
It's been widely documented that both your campaign and that of Republican Ashley Swearengin, who's running for state controller, are trying to maybe cast the GOP in a different light and maybe not having the GOP brand out in front as much as maybe we have seen in the past. And you both talked about being somewhat independent watchdogs in Sacramento if you were elected. What do you think that says about civic engagement and the nature of the Republican Party in California as it moves forward?
Yeah.
We've often talked about that Sacramento is becoming a one-party town.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. And at least my approach, and I can't speak for Mayor Swearengin, but my approach has always been that the California Republican Party actually has a unique history as a reform-minded party. Now, I know I'm going back quite a ways, but it was California Republicans who helped bring the initiative and referendum to the state of California because they saw a Sacramento that had been overrun by special interests. Obviously, in those days, it was the railroads.
This is Hiram Johnson about 102 years ago.
That's right. Well, I think that actually in a 21st century sense, and I mean that specifically with the growth of these technology transparency tools, that the Californians are willing to listen to a Republican Party that is willing to promote ideals of transparency, government performance, and responsiveness to citizens. And I think in that, that's really I maybe not have been running away from my GOP roots. There were many people, by the way, Joe, who advised me, friends of mine in the good government community, said, you know, Pete, you should just run as an independent. But I said, you know, I've been a Republican since I was old enough to vote, and I don't think it would be very transparent to do that. But at the same time, I really want to harken back to an identity of the party that really was not about tearing government down, but making it responsive and transparent. And I think actually the Secretary of State's office could be doing some very interesting things in all of those areas. And I think the party more broadly really should be a party that is out there wanting to make sure that government is run in a transparent way and that government is doing what we've asked it to do. So that really has been my approach to my party affiliation.
We've been talking with Pete Peterson. He is a Republican candidate for the office of Secretary of State. He is runs a civic engagement program at Pepperdine University. Pete, thank you so much for joining us on Valley Edition today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to a special two-hour broadcast of Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We spent most of our program today looking ahead to next week's election, and as always, you can find more on our website, including an interview with Mr. Peterson's opponent, Alex Padilla, on our website again at kvpr.org. But I thought we'd close today's program with something completely different, because the end of October and the start of November isn't just about politicians and ballot measures, it's also about pomegranates. This Saturday, the community of Madera will celebrate the delicious fruit with the Madera Pomegranate Festival, taking place at the Madera Airport just north of the city on Highway 99. Joining us now on the phone, we have Julie Hurd, Manager of Business Development and Marketing at the Madera County Economic Development Commission. Julie, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you. Thank you for having me this morning.
I understand the logo for your Pomegranate Festival says Madera at the heart of pomegranate country. Tell me about that to start out with. This is pomegranate country.
Right. Okay. So Madera County, we have a lot of pomegranate activity. We call ourselves mostly the hub. Now, the pomegranate industry has changed significantly over the past couple of years. Before we thought that... Before we could almost make the claim that pomegranate's not, I just want to make sure pomegranate would not be Madera's number one crop. That would, however, be grapes and almonds, but that Madera County had the most acreage of pomegranates. And over the years, the market has actually been saturated with pomegranate juice, and the tides have turned, and now pomegranates have been pulled out. So we can't necessarily make that sort of claim, but we do still have thousands of acres of pomegranates, and we also do juice processing in Madera County. There's a manufacturing company by the name of Steve's that does juice processing as well with pomegranates.
And we also have a couple of small manufacturers that also do frozen arils as well.
And there'll certainly be no shortage of pomegranates at the festival coming up on Saturday. Exactly what does a pomegranate festival involve?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it is all sorts of things. However, we do want to make sure it's centered around pomegranate because it is a food festival. So we will have cooking demonstrations, different dishes. We'll have a pomegranate bruschetta. We'll have somebody demonstrating lamb chops with pomegranates, a pomegranate salad. We also have a lot of food that will be available that's pomegranate-inspired. Then to just add to the entertainment, we're going to have a kids zone because this is a family-friendly event. And we're going to have fun things there like the Zoomobile. We'll have the Fossil Discovery Center's dig site. We're going to have a kids stage that will constantly have performances going on. The Madera Arts Council will be doing arts and crafts projects all day. We'll even have Jelly Belly out there with pomegranate-flavored jelly beans. And then not to also forget, the Marie Wilson Band will also be playing all day long. And then KZ24's top talent, Rachel Lamatut, will also be there doing a special performance for us.
Now, it's not just commercial pomegranate operations. A lot of people have pomegranate trees at their homes and have pomegranates. This is the time of year when they are ripe and just bursting with flavor. Do you find a lot of people looking for pomegranate recipes and ideas of what to do with the fruit or just like eating them raw?
No, absolutely. We are going to have the master gardeners there that are going to give any kind of advice that somebody needs on the care of their tree or their fruit. We're also going to have a vendor there who has a special device that helps you take the seeds out of the pomegranate. And then we're also going to do a demonstration to show people how you could remove all the arils out of a pomegranate in about 20 seconds.
Now that is fascinating. I would like to see that. Maybe you should put that up on YouTube. That sounds...
Yeah, it's really simple. Actually, you cut it in half lengthwise. And then you just pound it with a spoon, and all those little arils just drop out.
Ah, that's a nice tip. I'm going to have to try that. Well, I think we have some pomegranates floating around the station here.
If you go to YouTube, you will also see a demo. There's plenty of those demonstrations on there. But, yeah, most people don't realize that it's that simple.
If people want more information about the festival, where can they go?
They're going to go to our website, www.pomegranatefestival.com.
All right. Again, it's the Madera. The Madera's annual Pomegranate Festival taking place this Saturday, November 1st, from 10 till 4 p.m. at the Madera Municipal Airport, 4020 Aviation Drive, just north of the city of Madera on Highway 99. Again, our guest today has been Julie Hurd, the Manager of Business Development with the Madera County Economic Development Commission. Julie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org and find all of our 2014 election coverage on the web, kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter. We're @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition's producer and reporter, Ezra David Romero, for Valley Edition reporter, Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer, Marv Allen, and production and operation manager, Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.